This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Elder scams are a perennial threat, and earlier this year, a few high-profile, high-dollar scams made headlines here locally. Later in the show today, we'll look back at a conversation that we had with local law enforcement and elder advocates of the real risks that older people face and how communities can come together to help thwart would-be scammers. But first, Florida has a long history of tall tales and legends and an oral tradition that was helped along by outrageous characters and a relatively untamed landscape that resembled the Wild West. It's these verbally shared stories that have helped shape the identity of cultures around the world, and South Florida is one of them. Dr. Karen Neal is a scholar who has recently dedicated her studies to our state's taller tales, and she will present some of those stories this Thursday night at the Marco Island Historical Society. She joins us now on the phone from her office at Florida Atlantic University. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, Julie. Thank you.
We are talking about storytelling, not movie making, writing, or text messaging, but real live, face-to-face telling of stories. It's the way people learned about the world around them for centuries. With Dr. Karen Neal, she's an award-winning storyteller. Do you have a question or a comment? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. First, Dr. Neal, tell me about how folklore is defined. Are they always true stories or are they myths?
Well, there are so many questions about the term folklore, but generally what folklores mean when they use that term is the cultural products of a group. And a group can be defined by ethnicity, by geography. Even the students at my university are a group. So the cultural products may be the stories, they may be the riddles or the dances or the recipes or even the games that a group plays.
So folklore could be maybe like an umbrella, and then under that you have myths, you have true stories, tall tales, fantasies, things like that.
Right, and the characteristics that really bring folklore together, different aspects of folklore together, are a few. One of them is that the story or the recipe or the game can change with every person who transmits it. And the reason for that is because originally these things were transmitted through the oral tradition. That is, they weren't written down. So knowing how human memory is and knowing how humans like to innovate, we tell things in different ways. And finally, these things pass from generation to generation, what we call vertically, and they also pass horizontally from place to place. So we don't necessarily always know. This is the most controversial aspect of folklore, but we don't necessarily always know who is the creator of any particular work. For example, Bob Dylan, we say, writes folk songs, but we know who he is. We know that those ideas came mostly out of his head. But a game like hopscotch, who invented that? We don't know.
It's kind of hard to fact-check oral tradition, is what we're saying.
That's for sure.
Is there a risk, though, when a culture relies heavily on oral tradition? I mean, obviously, before the written word, we didn't really have much of a choice. But when a culture is relying on oral tradition, is there a risk, like in a game of telephone, that the facts get fuzzy and they become changed and they evolve in order to suit different, political climates or cultural innovations that are happening?
It's a great question, and there is a risk with any human enterprise, but we see that happening with the written word as well. Whom do you trust? What is the source that you can verify or not? What we say with folklore is, as long as you know, nobody's calling this history. We are calling this a folk tale or a myth or a legend, and as long as you know that what is important is not necessarily the specifics as much as the general theme. I'll give you an example. I often say to my students, it used to be that when the hunters went out, they didn't care so much how many buffalo they brought back. What they cared about was the bravery of the hunters. And that's something that you may use a different word for, you may exaggerate a little bit, but it's not so important to get wrong. What led human beings to develop writing, in fact, was commerce. When the number of buffalo was extremely important because you were trading them with something else.
Mm-hmm. So, but how does this work with cultures that are dependent on oral traditions? And I'm talking about like Native American societies, for example, or different tribes that really depend on oral tradition. Is there a threat of these stories or histories dying out if these stories aren't somehow recorded and retold?
Very much so. And in fact, I've just been reading a beautiful book on that subject where a writer wrote down the exact words of a Native American elder because he knew that people were not listening to the old stories anymore. And so more and more folklore is being codified, is being written down. And of course, what happens then is a different kind of a risk. The risk is that only that version from that teller is going to be valorized, is going to be honored and accepted as authentic and original, when actually there's no such thing. There are many, many different what we call variants or versions of the same, whether it's a piece of material culture that is a bowl or a chopstick or something like that, or whether it's a story.
Is it that kind of evolution of the story through time that makes storytelling and that tradition so rich?
I think you're right. And I think that we're talking about a Western individualized society, individualistic society, when we say we've got to get the author's name, we've got to get the authentic version, whereas many non-Western societies and the way the West used to be is much more about the community. It's much more about, well, we all have our versions. We all share in that story. Storytellers talk a lot about the word co-creation. That is, when I tell you a story and I'm looking in your eyes and I'm responding to your energy, you are helping me create that story. You, by your laughter at a certain point, by your interest that you may show, by leaning forward, that motivates me to tell the story in a certain way. So listeners and tellers alike are shaping a new variant or a new version of folklore all the time.
And you mentioned a minute ago how the West used to be in the way storytelling happened. Early Florida was a bit of a frontier for longer than a lot of other eastern states, sort of like an old West. Does that kind of climate, you know, newly settled, a little bit less cosmopolitan, does this kind of an environment give rise to more oral traditions or more storytelling?
I think it keeps it alive longer. I also think, even though where I live, down in Boca Raton, you really don't feel like you're in the South. In the South in general, in this country, there is a strong motivation to keep storytelling alive. But I think to some extent, you're absolutely right, to another extent, wherever, I mean, I talk often about the folklore of fire stations. You know, people sitting around and they've got time and they play games and they tell stories and they cook for themselves. To some extent, there is an oral tradition in any group where there are people who don't sit at their phones and their computers all day, where they share their experiences and their knowledge. But I think the short answer to your question is absolutely this area has such a rich culture, and many people who are non-native to Florida think of it as something that is relatively new. And of course, it was the Spanish came here in 1513. I don't want to say it was discovered in 1513. The Spanish came here then, and it has been a state just a little more than 150 years.
I guess
there is a lot of tradition.
And there would be also the effect of being kind of interdependent and dealing with one another in a commerce kind of a way, and less being cold and staying in your home and not interacting as much with other people. That might probably have some sort of an impact, too, as far as, you know, the climate and the being among other people to share these stories.
That's a beautiful point, absolutely. And we also have a very rich diversity of cultures in this state, and many of the people who've come from other places or many of the native tribes who have been here already have that tradition of sharing culture and of keeping culture alive.
We are talking about storytelling with one of the most accomplished Florida storytellers, Dr. Karen Neal. Give us a call with your thoughts or questions at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And then along the lines of being isolated, I guess I would like to ask, do you feel like storytelling is going away with people watching TV, looking at computers? Do you feel like face-to-face human storytelling is kind of falling by the wayside?
Well, I do tend sometimes to call it the Rodney Dangerfield of art forms. In other words, it doesn't get a whole lot of respect. A lot of times people think I'm going to hand out milk and cookies and I'm going to read them a picture book. And that's unfortunate because, of course, not only are fictional tales and folklore so rich with meaning. I mean, they used to be the soap operas of earlier generations. People would share stories. But also, we tell stories all the time. I mean, on one level, yes, we are staring at screens more than ever. Well, we didn't have those screens all that long ago, even TV screens. But on another level, you'll see people, once they understand that what they're doing is storytelling, they see it everywhere, and they appreciate it so much. There is a movement that is about, I'm going to say maybe 20 years old, called The Moth, which is a story slam that originated in New York and is now all over the country, and I think they're doing story slams, maybe not The Moth, overseas as well. I do a version of it here, and that is, anybody who wants can get up in a public place and tell a story. And that has really captured the imagination of people of all generations. It's a wonderful thing to see. So on one level, yes, maybe we don't tell stories of Cinderella or of Hercules as much as we used to, but we certainly love to tell our own stories, whether it's on podcasts, the radio, or live, or in our own living rooms.
Well, when I talked to you earlier on the phone, you mentioned that storytelling is a little hard to do on the phone, but it's easiest, it's best to do in person. Why is that?
We tend to think of storytelling as primarily about words. But the definition that professional storytellers use that comes by way of a wonderful storyteller named Doug Lipman and the National Storytelling Network, which is the professional organization of storytellers, is a six-point definition. The first is words. Yeah, if we do a hula dance and we say the hands tell the story, that isn't really what we mean by storytelling. Not that we're the gatekeepers, not that we're the owners of the term, but professional storytellers mean we use words. Next, we use imagination. So we like to think that our journalists use a limited amount of imagination when they report a story. We like to think that they try to get keep their stories as factual as possible. Well, even when I'm telling a bit of history, I am imagining how somebody feels. I am imagining perhaps what something tastes like or looks like, so that the listener can actually feel that he or she is experiencing that. The third part of the definition is narrative. I can't tell you how many times I hear somebody say, oh, that's my story. Well, what they just said is not a story at all. It's some information. And a story has a narrative arc, what we say in literature. A story has a beginning, middle, and an end. A story is sequential. A story is certain things that other kind of information is not, which is why storytelling is so powerful. The fourth part of the six-part definition, interaction. And that's really what I was talking about primarily when I was talking about not being able to tell a story as well over the phone. It's what I was talking about when I mentioned co-creation. In other words, I am responding to you.
So now if you're in the middle of telling a story and you see someone kind of lean forward and, you know, there just seem really engaged. Do you then take your story and go that direction because you can see that you've got somebody hooked on that?
Exactly right. Exactly right. And the last part, I think I said six, I meant five. The last part is nonverbal communication. That's what you're talking about, mm-hmm. whether it's on the part of the storyteller or whether it's on the part of the listener. It is so powerful to watch people's communication rather than just to listen. You know, speakers and storytellers know that so much of what an audience remembers is visual. We are, especially in the West, we are visual creatures. So if I'm smiling and I say, I hate you, you'll probably believe the smile before you believe the I hate you or I hate this, but I'm smiling. Most of us take for granted that the visual is true. We say seeing is believing. So when you see my face and my gestures and my posture and the way I use space, what's called proxemics, you are persuaded in the truth of the story. You are connected to me. All that good stuff that happens when a story is told is that much more potent when you can see the storyteller.
Well, and I know you say that it's kind of tough to do storytelling when you're not in person, but you're also right now working on a book about South Florida stories in which you talk about the enigmatic Wallace Simpson. We have just a few minutes left. Can you tell me a little bit about this figure and how she's part of Florida's history?
Well, actually, the book is on all of Florida's stories, and Wallace Simpson was an American who was raised by her uncle Solomon Davies Warfield in part. She was supported by him, raised by her mother, after her father died. And he decided that he wanted, he was a railroad magnat, a Baltimore banker and railroad executive, and he owned the Seaboard line in an airline railway, now called the Seaboard Coastline, linking East and West Florida. So he decided that his company's southern headquarters were going to be in Indian Town, which is about 35 miles from West Palm. He created a model city, and he wanted that to be his legacy for Indian Town. So he had experts design streets and housing and even a school. And he felt that the town needed an elegant hotel. So he built one, the Seminole Inn, and he brought down his niece and ward, Wallace, to come and, actually, she was 30 years old at the time. Her name was Bessie Wallace, but she had taken on the name Wallace, called herself Wallace instead. She had left China, where she had been with a husband, and she had created a minor scandal there, a little bit of loose living. And he thought it would be nice. She was very stylish. She was very elegant. He wanted her to come and open this hotel for him. So she was the hostess the night the hotel opened. Unfortunately, a few months later, the nasty 1926 hurricane occurred, and it was the beginning of the end of the land boom. The town fell on bad times. The old man died. And whom did she remarry? She remarried, first she remarried someone else, and then she remarried a little bit later the Prince of Wales. Actually, he was the former Prince of Wales. He became the future. He became King Edward VII. And when she married him, of course, he had to abdicate the throne because she was an American divorcee.
Yeah, with two living husbands.
This was the famous Wallace Simpson. He became the Duke of Windsor. She became the Duchess of Windsor.
Yeah, I mean, and that was right there in Indian Town. So this, and that was in her earlier part
right
of her life.
There. And she visited that place again once or twice, but she was the center of the biggest scandal of 1936.
Yeah, that was. She went on to lead quite the interesting life, too, from there on. So that, it's interesting that she has a connection here to Florida, and I don't know if that many people really even know that.
Probably not.
So what is one tip before we leave? We're almost out of time, but what's a tip that we can leave listeners with today to make their storytelling just a little bit better?
The storyteller's stock in trade is emotion. if I recite a list of facts, I have no connection to them, you have no connection to them. But if I can make you feel that you were there with detail, if I can make you experience what I experienced, then you're going to feel. And when you feel something, I have formed a connection, and you have had an experience. That's good storytelling.
Getting people invested in understanding what the human experience is. Once they're there, then you can convey more information.
That's a great way of saying it. And you can really teach a lot through storytelling. Plato once said, and I always tell my students, I didn't know him personally, but the great Greek philosopher Plato said, as we love, so we learn. When our emotions are kindled, we remember better what we've learned. And wouldn't it be wonderful if we could all learn in a way that would help us remember the best?
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. It's been really a fun and enlightening show. It's great talking with you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, I loved it. Thank you. Thank you so much.
So if you're interested in seeing the presentation that Dr. Karen Neal will be putting on at the Marco Island Historical Society, you can check out WGCUnews.org online, and you can click on the Gulf Coast Live tab to find links. Coming up, a look back at a cautionary tale for seniors, we revisit a segment from February in which we explored the many ways scam artists get into our parents' and grandparents' pocketbooks, and we look at ways to stop them. I'm Julie Glenn, and this is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.
Return to the ordinary world. The ordinary world. Return to the ordinary world. But that's another story.